Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. I'm the Compliance Evangelist, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 390 of the FCPA Compliance Report. Today, I have back with me James Koukios. James is a partner at Morrison & Foerster, and he and his firm put out a monthly international anti-corruption newsletter. Today, we go over some of the highlights from the April newsletter. We talk about the Dun & Bradstreet declination, how the IMF steps up engagement on corporate governance and corruption. We take a look at individual prosecutions related to PDVSA and what this may all mean going forward. We discuss the bookends of an FCPA case involving a Florida-based telecom executive pleading guilty to FCPA violations, bookended with an Aruban state-owned enterprise official pleading guilty to money laundering. We consider some of the hot spots in the globe where companies may need to take a very much closer look at their business operations. We focus on South America and Malaysia. We conclude by taking a look at the subpoena, which was recently issued to Glencore by the Department of Justice, partly around corruption issues. And James gives us a very good discussion about the reasons why the Department of Justice would issue a subpoena and what it may mean for the investigation going forward. The FCPA Compliance Report is a part of the Compliance Podcast Network. Fox, back again for another episode. Today, I'm delighted to have back with me James Koukios. James is a partner in Morrison & Foerster in Washington, D.C., and his firm puts out just an excellent resource, a monthly newsletter, not on FCPA, but on international anti-corruption issues. And we're here today to talk about some topics from the April newsletter with a special added bonus of a current event. So, James, with that introduction, thank you for taking the time to visit with me today, and welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure.
So let's just jump right into it, James. We had a what I thought was just a fabulous settlement for a lot of reasons in March, which was reported in the April newsletter, the Dun & Bradstreet settlement. This, in my mind, was, if not the first, certainly one of the first under the new FCPA corporate enforcement policy announced by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in November of 2017. Dun & Bradstreet received a full declination. They met all four prongs of the new enforcement policy: self-disclosure, extensive cooperation, extensive remediation, and profit disgorgement. But I thought the case really had a lot more than that. And I was wondering, kind of from your perspective, James, what did you guys see in that case?
Yes, Tom, I agree with you. This is the first publicly reported case that has cited to the new corporate enforcement policy. Of course, previous to that, we had some cases that cited to the FCPA pilot program. But as you noted, the new corporate enforcement policy that DAG Rosenstein announced in November of last year replaced the FCPA pilot program. So this is the first, at least publicly announced, declination under that new program. A couple things did strike me, though, Tom. You know, one of the reasons I think that DOJ likely, it's not entirely in there, but one of the reasons I think that DOJ likely declined in this case is because the SEC decided to go forward. And I just found it interesting that, you know, there's no criminal penalty here, but because DOJ didn't go forward, SEC seems to have decided that they were going to do a civil penalty on top of it. Ordinarily, if there's a coordinated resolution, SEC will waive the civil penalty in lieu of the criminal penalty. Here, DOJ said, look, you did everything right. We're going to decline under the new principles outlined in the new enforcement policy. But at the same time, the SEC said, okay, well, we'll take that penalty ourselves. Now, who knows? It probably was still a pretty big savings. The DOJ penalty could have been much higher. But I thought that was it was definitely a good result for Dun & Bradstreet, but it was a little less good than it maybe could have been under that, if SEC had not decided not to go forward with a civil penalty as well. So that struck me at first, you know, one hand giveth and the other taketh away.
That's an interesting interpretation, James, because I saw that as, actually maybe a little bit differently. One was, generally, under the anti-piling on, or what I previously called the one pie policy, in conjunction with the new FCPA corporate enforcement policy in the U.S. Attorney's Manual that required profit disgorgement, so that by going forward with the civil side, The SEC satisfied that component of the new FCPA corporate enforcement policy, and actually, I guess I saw that as a kind of a greater unity, one pie and a piling on to get to the result of a declination on the criminal side with the settlement on the SEC side.
Yeah, though the disgorgement definitely occupies that space. You're right about that. It's just I reacted to the penalty a little more than the disgorgement, because SEC always takes disgorgement. Not always. 95% of the time they take disgorgement. Sometimes they just proceed with a civil penalty. So I saw that civil penalty sitting out there as a, wow, that's an interesting use of discretion when DOJ decided to decline. That's just my opinion. I think most companies would prefer to have at least one declination out of this. So it definitely was a benefit for Dun & Bradstreet. I think the other thing to make clear is, you know, if you read the paperwork and things like that, the Dun & Bradstreet investigation predated the corporate enforcement policy. And so what this also tells us is that even though technically Dun & Bradstreet didn't make a disclosure, et cetera, under the corporate enforcement policy, that DOJ is taking the position that it will still apply the principles of that policy to ongoing investigations.
So I guess, and maybe as a final point, James, this settlement and even our discussion show that when you have a declination, there's still a lot to unpack and really a lot for everyone in this space to learn from. Certainly people like yourself in the white collar defense bar, but for the corporate compliance practitioner and even the corporate in-house counsel, a lot to understand, a lot to talk about internally, and a lot to go into your decision making on whether you self-disclose or not going forward.
Absolutely. Always the hardest question a company asks itself is self-disclosure.
So lots to unpack. Next up, James, you brought in an entity that I really don't see a lot of talk about in the FCPA world, although they're huge in the global stage, and that's the International Monetary Fund. And you had a short piece on the IMF stepping up its engagement on governance and corruption, announcing that its executive board had endorsed a new framework on this for its member countries. Typically, the IMF works at a different level, but I was wondering if you guys saw this as having a direct meaning for companies that operate in IMF countries, which is basically every country in the world, perhaps except Cuba and North Korea.
Right. I'm not sure it's going to have a direct effect, but I think it could have an indirect effect. Essentially, what the IMF was saying is, you know, back in 1997, we established some very, what we believe are good governance standards, but the world has changed, and we know more about corruption since then and money laundering. So we're going to go and we're going to revisit those, and we're going to, following that revisit, there's a report that was released. The IMF decided that they were going to update their governance framework for the modern day. And so they put a number of recommendations and new policies in place. The biggest one is that they're going to play a more active role in monitoring countries' governance standards when it comes to anti-corruption, both on the countries that are receiving IMF funds. But they, interestingly enough, they said they're also going to look at the role of private companies in anti-corruption efforts as well. And to that extent, it actually sounds a lot like the OECD anti-bribery convention or the GRECO type of reviews, because the IMF asked the G7 and some other countries if they would agree to reviewing their anti-corruption frameworks, including their anti-corruption laws and penalties, and see if they're sufficient to deter foreign bribery. So not only are they going to look at the countries that are receiving IMF funds, but they're also going to be looking at the countries that may be supplying, and they use this term supply side in the document, supplying bribes to those countries that may affect negatively the work of the IMF. In that regard, it sounds a lot like the peer review process of the OECD or the GRECO analysis, where they're looking at both entities are looking at whether the country's laws are sufficient to prevent foreign bribery and whether the penalties are sufficient to dissuade foreign bribery. So I think it's probably not going to be a direct impact. I don't think companies are going to start getting hauled in before the IMF or things like that. But to the extent that there's another body that's looking at these issues and encouraging anti-corruption efforts and enforcement, I think there could be an indirect impact in that regard.
I just found it, like I said, really interesting. We typically, we don't see the IMF, but I guess certainly you've been a part of the OECD peer review process, James, as you've talked about in prior episodes. And that process, I think, drives a lot of discussions at enforcement levels, at levels, you know, that you work at with clients. And then certainly even inside corporations, simply because it sets benchmarks by which governments are going to look at compliance programs. And then that gives insights to people like myself or people like yourself on what individual organizations may need to do if they want to do business with those governments. So I always find it encouraging when one of the major global NGOs steps up, not to steal their phrase, but steps up and engages more on this and brings it up, as you said, really into the 2018 timeframe.
That's right. Those are good points, Tom. The other thing is IMF works closely with World Bank. So any companies doing business with the World Bank could also see some trickle-down effect from this as well.
James, next up, we had a continued story that just seems to never end, and it's individual prosecutions around PDVSA, the Venezuelan National Oil Company. Here we had, or back in March, we had a more guilty pleas and indictments of individuals, and the tightening of the sanctions against Venezuela. We've actually had the Venezuelan government come to the United States and file civil actions to try to get some monies back that were paid for bribes. So I was wondering if you just might unpack that a little bit, starting with the individual prosecutions of Venezuelans who were involved in bribery while they were at PDVSA and came to the United States. And do you see this as just a continuing story?
Yeah, this is for me, full disclosure, I worked on this case when I was at DOJ, and obviously will not reveal any inside baseball or confidential facts in that. But I've long thought this is just a great story, given the amount of investigative effort and wherewithal put into this case by DOJ and the enforcement agencies working on it as well. But we had in April the 11th guilty plea in this case. And one very significant thing here is that those guilty pleas have been both on the supply side and the demand side. So this most recent guilty plea was by a former general manager of a procurement subsidiary of PDVSA. And the allegations have been that various folks, including folks who are based in the United States, were paying bribes to get favorable contracts and favorable payment treatment and the like from these PDVSA procurement subsidiaries and other parts of PDVSA. And just really interesting, I mean, the DOJ has decided to go, it's almost roughly 50-50 between officials being charged and the private citizens being charged with the bribery. And so I think we've got a very interesting dynamic here. We've got both the supply side and the demand side being prosecuted equally vigorously in this case. I think part of that has to do with the fact that a lot of the conduct took place in Houston, which I know is near and dear to you, Tom, but also Miami and other places in the United States. A lot of the officials actually were based in Houston who took the bribes, even though it was they were working for a Venezuelan state-owned and controlled entity. So it's just very, historically, I think we've talked about this in the past, because DOJ can't charge officials with FCPA violations directly, sometimes they do bring money laundering or travel act charges against them. But typically that happens when there's a really strong U.S. nexus. And so the fact that a lot of this conduct and a lot of the people were actually based in Houston on both sides of the bribery transaction, I think is one of the reasons that DOJ has felt comfortable charging the official in this case with it. Some of them weren't, though, and they have gone after folks that were actually based in Venezuela as well, which is quite aggressive, but probably reflects the fact that, you know, PDVSA sells a lot of oil to the United States. It has a subsidiaries here in the United States, and so there really is a connection here to the United States.
One of the things that's really interested me, obviously the Houston connections have been a big interest to me. Citgo, the largest subsidiary of PDVSA, is headquartered here in Houston. So far, they've avoided sanctions and really avoided any of the problems that bedeviled PDVSA and its employees around bribery and corruption. But it seems to me that it's really all of this is tied together. And your insights about the individuals who engaged in illegal activities in the United States, I certainly agree with that. But as you said, we have seen individuals indicted who reside in Spain, who reside in Venezuela. And I would only ask, would you consider this story to be continued, James?
Absolutely. I mean, they just keep rolling out charges after charges. I mean, one of the interesting things here is a lot of the charges, I think at one point, were under seal and things like that, so they could try to go and get folks who are living overseas to, you know, encourage them to travel and things like that. And so I think I do think that this is probably going to continue for quite some time. And there's probably, and again, this is just based on what's actually unfolded. There's a good chance that there may be additional people charged that we just don't know about, but we'll learn about at some point in the future, as we've seen happen in this case so far.
Well, it sounds like this may be one we can revisit going forward. And that really leads into the next one, which I thought was really a fascinating case for a couple of reasons. But here we had a what I call the bookend of an FCPA enforcement, where in March we had a guilty plea made by a U.S. citizen named Lawrence Parker Jr., who had some telecom companies, and he bribed a telecom official in the Aruban telecom ministry to get contracts. We had the Aruban official had relocated to Miami, so he was subject to U.S. jurisdiction, and he pled guilty in June. But it really drove home the point you made about the bookending of anti-corruption enforcement, where obviously you have a bribe payer and a bribe receiver. We rarely get to see the bribe receiver come to justice here in the United States. And I was just wondering if this case had any interesting points for you, simply because we had such a clear bookend of enforcement.
Yeah, so this is a fact pattern that should be extremely familiar, that being a South Florida telecommunications company paying bribes to officials in Latin America and the Caribbean. Obviously, I the Eskenazi case is probably the most famous one. I tried that case, but that was a South Florida telecom company paying bribes to Haitian officials. The Latinode case that I was involved in also was South Florida telecom companies paying bribes to Honduran officials. And Alcatel had folks in Miami or going through Miami to pay bribes to Costa Rican telecom officials. So this is a pretty standard fact pattern at this point, especially involving South Florida and Latin America and the Caribbean. But, you know, that does reflect the fact that South Florida is such a international hub, especially for Latin America and the Caribbean. Again, as I mentioned before, most of the cases that DOJ brought against officials involved a lot of contact with the U.S. All the cases I just mentioned fall into that category. You know, folks from the Caribbean come to South Florida quite a bit. They oftentimes reside there part of the year. They certainly do a lot of commercial transactions, whether they're buying things or banking in South Florida. And so we do see quite often the officials that end up getting charged are from Latin America and the Caribbean, because they have so much contact with South Florida and engage in commerce and banking in South Florida. So I think this is a good example of that. We've got the Aruban telecom official who is bribed by a South Florida telecom company and ends up, as you mentioned, Tom, in South Florida. So I think this definitely falls into sort of that heartland of the cases that DOJ typically would consider bringing against both sides, the bookends, the bribe payer and the bribe recipient in those cases. It also, you know, just from a practical standpoint, when the transactions are actually done in the United States, it's a lot easier to get the evidence. You know, a lot of the cases that are hard to bring are the ones where the transactions may be done in a jurisdiction where DOJ can't get evidence from. But especially if the actual banking and spending and things like that is going on in the United States, it makes it a lot easier for DOJ to bring cases. And I think you'll see, if you look over our last several months of top 10s, there has been a huge outbreak of individual cases being brought against individuals in South Florida. And I think it reflects the fact that South Florida is such an important gateway to Latin America and the Caribbean, and so much business is done down there that it does lend itself to a lot of FCPA cases because there can be FCPA jurisdiction there.
You know, and here I was just thinking that it was just the wild and woolly world of Miami from the 80s and 90s going forward, but there's actually a substantive business reason as well.
Sure.
And I'd really focused on Houston and energy because Houston is much more Mexico, Central American, and South American focused than the Caribbean. Once again, focused on energy.
Yes.
I was wondering, James, if you could tell us kind of specifically, what are the tools available to the Department of Justice against the bribe receiver as opposed to perhaps the bribe payer?
Sure. So, I mean, as I mentioned, the charges are somewhat limited because you can't bring an FCPA charge against the bribe receiver. But DOJ does make good use of money laundering, anti-money laundering laws, as well as Travel Act, and in some cases, wire fraud as well. And then, of course, the DOJ Kleptocracy Initiative focuses on the proceeds. So DOJ also goes and tries to use the forfeiture laws to try to get the proceeds that the bribe receiver may have received or either received or purchased or acquired with the ill-gotten money. So there's quite a bit. It's less robust than it is against the bribe payer because the FCPA is only available against the bribe payer, but still has a lot of tools that DOJ can use against the bribe recipient.
James, I'm wondering if now we might turn to perhaps a little more speculative discussion, but one of the things I've been wanting to ask you, I have really, every time I have the chance to talk, told people that if they've done business in South Africa literally over the past 10 years, they need to scrub and do business that would impact the FCPA, meaning doing business with a government agency or a state-owned enterprise. They need to scrub as closely as they can the entire business relationship, the transactions, the money spent, any third parties, any local black-owned enterprises they may have engaged. And now we've had a elected regime change, a peaceful change in Malaysia, where they have had an ongoing scandal with their sovereign wealth fund that you mentioned, the Anti-Kleptocracy Act, and the Department of Justice had been very active in going after monies that were allegedly stolen from that fund previously. But I was just wondering if you have any thoughts of countries that companies should be looking at, sort of beyond the usual suspects that are found in the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index.
Sure. And, you know, we always say that no country has monopoly on anti-corruption, right? I mean, it can happen anywhere. It happens in the United States. There's the FBI and DOJ bring plenty of cases against corrupt officials, even here at home. So I just preface it by saying I'm not singling out any country as being particularly bad or good. It's just because we see these actions happening all over the world. But I think you raise good points. I mean, one thing I think companies should really look at is what countries are in the news right now for corruption allegations, because there's a good chance that DOJ and SEC are reading the same newspaper articles as are the local law enforcement folks. And so, you know, these things kind of a snowball effect. We saw it in Brazil. I think Brazil continues to be one of those countries where you really have to look very closely when you're doing business there. but the Lava Jato investigation just continues to go. And what that really happened there, I think that's important for multinationals, is that Brazil and the United States and other jurisdictions, France, for example, have developed these really close law enforcement relationships. And so if there's even a domestic bribery investigation going on in Brazil, U.S. companies and other multinationals should look to see, do we do business in that sector? Is it possible that the Brazilian authorities are sharing information with DOJ? The same thing can be true. As you said, Malaysia, it's a good point. Oftentimes when there's a regime change, especially if there's corruption allegations going around, the new regime may try to use those corruption allegations, if I'm cynical, in order to consolidate their power and try to go against the former regime. And so they may start to provide evidence and information as well. So I think it's important to look kind of where has there been some corruption allegations with a regime change or change in party. Right now, we're actually seeing a lot of activity in Greece. The ruling party in Greece is deeply unpopular because of some of the promises that people think were broken in how that ruling party approached the bailout in Greece. And they are using anti-corruption. They're using corruption as a political tool in many ways to try to solidify their position against the prior ruling party by saying the prior ruling party was receiving bribes and things like that. And so I think Greece is kind of back in the news after it had been quiet for a while. And there's other places around the world, just continue to look for that to see where is there a lot of publicity going on, where is there regime change, where is there an active domestic anti-corruption movement going on as well. So, I think those are some of the places to look, but it changes all the time. DOJ and SEC definitely learn from their experiences. And so where DOJ and SEC have been active are also places to continue to look at as well.
And James, I wanted to ask, this is more of a current event than came from the firm's newsletter, but something came up this week that I really want to lean on your expertise on. And it involves a public announcement that a company called Glencore, which is a European-based mining company, had received a subpoena from the Department of Justice. At least part of the subpoena dealt with some corruption issues. And there was a huge response in the press. It depressed Glencore stock. And it just seemed to me companies, I would assume, get subpoenas not on a routine basis, but it's certainly not unusual. But I wanted to ask you, from your perspective as a former DOJer, what is the significance, if any, of the DOJ sending a subpoena, and why would there be such at least a public response at this point?
Sure. So, the default for DOJ when it comes to FCPA investigations and other white collar, oftentimes as well, is to start out with voluntary document requests. And I think, generally speaking, companies prefer voluntary document requests. It's kind of a more an atmospheric aspect than it is maybe a pure legal significance. But DOJ does try to start out typically with voluntary document requests, and companies typically try to keep it within that realm. There are times, however, where DOJ feels it has to go by grand jury subpoena instead. Sometimes, and I'm not saying that's happening here because I don't know, but sometimes it's because there's a perception maybe that the company is not providing documents it should as part of the voluntary request if it's an ongoing matter. It may be that the investigation proceeded without the company for a long time, and DOJ has amassed a lot of evidence and they don't feel like they need to go proceed by voluntary request because they already have the goods. And sometimes the company requests a grand jury subpoena, especially if there's data privacy or other kind of sensitivities that by providing information voluntarily, they could be subject to a lawsuit or penalties or stuff like that. And so there's a lot of different reasons why a grand jury subpoena might be in play. And it's hard to necessarily know from the outside, you know, is this something the company wanted or something the company didn't want? And why did DOJ proceed this way instead of another way? Or did they also proceed the other way before, but now they're moving over to a grand jury subpoena as well? So it's, you know, just because a company receives a grand jury subpoena does not mean it's the end of the world. It does make it a little more important, and there's more consequences in some ways of complying with a grand jury subpoena, because you can be subject to contempt of court and things like that. Not that you ever want to withhold anything improperly from DOJ from a voluntary document request either, but the grand jury subpoena makes it a lot more, it makes it easier for DOJ to try to file contempt charges and things like that against the company. So when you do get a grand jury subpoena request, it's very important that you probably engage a very experienced white collar law firm that can help the company get the documents together, create a good record of how it did that, and you know, take it very seriously in terms of producing documents. Again, not that you wouldn't do the same thing with a voluntary document request, but the grand jury subpoena does tend to raise the volume a bit.
Well, James, this has been a fascinating exploration, not only of the April firm newsletter on international anti-corruption updates, but also educating me on what it means to receive a subpoena. So thank you so much, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. If you have any questions on this episode, you can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. I've linked to the Morrison & Foerster April Top 10 Anti-Corruption Highlight Report in the show notes to the podcast. If you have listened to this podcast on iTunes, I would greatly appreciate it if you would rate our podcast, as it would help in our rankings and help get the word out about the oldest podcast in compliance. Thank you again for listening to this episode, and I hope you'll join me again next week for another episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. The FCPA Compliance Report is a part of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.